Joe, and I don't have to tell you, relationships are critical in Washington. But how do you A, find out who the key players are, and B, figure out how to reach out to them? Well, I want to tell you about Leadership Connect. It's been an absolute lifesaver for us as we expand our operations and outreach here at Washing Tech. Leadership Connect, it's the digital service used by top federal contractors and government affairs leaders to contact decision makers and develop those strategic relationships. Visit leadershipconnect.io and join the community. I love it, and I'm 100% sure you will too. That's leadershipconnect.io. Try it now.
For the first time ever, in responding to an emergency pandemic, Americans are going to have to rely on the internet extensively for an indeterminate amount of time. And so millions more Americans, all Americans, have got to get connected right now.
Welcome to the Washing Tech Policy Podcast.
The latest tech law and policy news and brightest tech law and policy experts wherever you are.
So you can stay informed on the move in less time.
From Washington, D.C., it's the Washing Tech Policy Podcast.
With Joe Miller.
Zoom comes under fire for privacy violations as Americans scramble to the platform to stay in touch. Special ed students and students without broadband struggle to access remote learning. And FCC Commissioner Jeffrey Starks is my guest today. Hey, everybody. I hope you're staying well. Zoom, which has been the darling of remote workers in recent weeks, is under fire for privacy violations. A Zoom user in California sued the company, claiming it improperly shared their data with Facebook. Also, so-called Zoom bombers have been interrupting meetings, breaching Zoom's privacy and security systems. In one incident, black students at the University of Texas at Austin were conducting a meeting on the platform, only to be interrupted by someone making racial slurs. The FBI has reported Zoom bombing incidents nationwide, and New York Attorney General Letitia James wrote to Zoom leadership requesting a faster response to these and other security breaches. School systems across the country have launched remote learning platforms for their students in response to the coronavirus epidemic and school closures associated with it. But remote learning poses unique challenges for those without internet access at home, and the $2 trillion stimulus empowered Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos to cut funding and support for accommodations for special education students. The New York Court of Appeals, the state of New York's highest court, has ruled that Postmates delivery workers are entitled to receive unemployment insurance benefits. The decision has implications for gig workers throughout New York, including Uber and Lyft drivers. New York State Attorney General Letitia James applauded the decision. Multiple reports found last week that federal officials are prying into cell phone tracking data to assess how the coronavirus is spreading. Advocates argue that data collection is necessary, but guardrails should be established to ensure that federal officials don't use the data as a backdoor to conduct warrantless surveillance, which they have been angling to do for some time. Tech companies are scrambling to respond to ever-evolving risks to the electoral system. The New York Times reports that a number of tactics that Facebook, Twitter, and Google began implementing to defend against misinformation online are being tested by politicians themselves, with Mike Bloomberg's campaign investing directly in Instagram meme accounts, promoting his campaign, for example. The company spent billions to deal with threats happening in plain sight, the most well-known examples being those conducted by Russia with the assistance of Cambridge Analytica and prominent Republicans. But the stealthier approaches taken by bad actors 4 years later underscores the need to invest even more resources to address the newest attacks. The Federal Communications Commission has approved $300 million in telehealth initiatives designed to ensure that folks in remote areas can access telehealth applications while they're stuck at home. But the funding is directed towards providers themselves, and most grants will be for less than $1 million. Part of the money will also be used to address remote access issues that have plagued the country for decades. Finally, the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia ruled last week that journalists and others are free to investigate platforms for signs of algorithmic bias, even if it means submitting false information to the site that would violate the site's terms of service. The American Civil Liberties Union brought a pre-enforcement lawsuit on behalf of two Northeastern University computer science professors to prevent the Department of Justice from attempting to use the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act to prevent investigators from using evasive tactics to assess the extent to which a platform engages in algorithmic bias. Department of Justice argued that such violations would violate a platform's First Amendment rights, but the decision turned on whether the site had set up adequate permissions such that an investigator, scholar, or journalist could be found to have exceeded the granted permission level. The court found that breaching terms of service agreements doesn't rise to the high level of permission granted by, say, an authentication gate, which adds another level of permission by requiring a password. And you can find links to all of these stories in the show notes. Stay with us.
You're plugged into the Washing Tech Policy Podcast, the inclusive voice of tech policy.
My guest today is the Honorable Jeffrey Starks, who is nominated to serve as a commissioner on the Federal Communications Commission by the president and was unanimously confirmed by the United States Senate on January 2nd, 2019. He was sworn into office on January 30th, 2019. Previously, Commissioner Starks served as Assistant Bureau Chief in the FCC's Enforcement Bureau, Senior Counsel in the Office of the Deputy Attorney General at the U.S. Department of Justice, where he received the Attorney General Award for Exceptional Service, the highest award a DOJ employee can receive. Commissioner Starks is a native of Kansas and was born in Kansas City, Missouri. And he earned a Bachelor's of Arts degree from Harvard, high honors, and a law degree from Yale Law School. Commissioner Starks, welcome to the show.
Glad to be with you here, Joe.
So over the last year of your tenure as a commissioner at the FCC, you've been using the term internet inequality instead of digital divide. First of all, did Larry Irving approve of that? And I'd love to know what your thoughts in light of the COVID-19 pandemic. You know, we've already seen the consequences that a lack of broadband access has had on our school-age children, college students, employees, parents who have to homeschool now, and our elderly community. You know, the affordability gap is more pronounced than ever as well. And, you know, it shows what an equity issue this is. Tell us about the communities you're most concerned about and that will be most affected. Let's go into depth here.
Well, I deeply appreciate the question. It's a great question. And to answer, Larry Irving and I are set to sit down for a virtual lunch. And so Larry and I are certainly going to chop it up on this. You know, this COVID-19 pandemic is unlike anything that we've ever seen in our lifetime. And the public health crisis is reframing a number of inequities. And whether that's paid sick leave, the cost of health care, or as you mentioned, the lack of access to affordable broadband. And I'm just not talking to DC policy wonks here, but the rippling effects of internet inequality are everywhere. And so the most marginalized communities is where my mind has gone first. You mentioned school-age children, and for some students, we know that the most consistent place for them to get a meal, whether that's a Head Start breakfast or a school lunch 5 days a week. And so I know a number of mayors are thinking about these Title I schools and their students. And from my perspective, certainly as a commissioner at the FCC, these are the same kids whose parents simply can't afford a costly internet bill, no matter the urgency. And so we have to do something about that and those students and those families. And then, of course, beyond just school-age children, I have been working with those who are experiencing homelessness. And so last week I had was on a conference call with representative from Miriam's Kitchen there. Miriam's Kitchen, located here in D.C., as well as the Larkin Street Youth Services Center and Shelter Tech, both in San Francisco. And those folks were telling me about the those who were experiencing homelessness there, and told me that this pandemic has impacted their clients in a lot of ways. We're talking about the public health crisis no longer allows them to visit libraries, visit public spaces where they can access Wi-Fi and charge their devices. And so the unhoused community is another large marginalized community that I'm thinking about. Last thing that I would point out here, Joe, is simply to acknowledge the point that you were driving at. When Larry Irving coined the term digital divide, that was back in the 90s, you know, so we've been talking about digital divide issues now for 25 years or more. And now the digital divide, of course, is the COVID-19 divide, and we've got to do something fiercely now.
Yeah, you know, one of the things from my perspective as a parent is trying to wrap my arms around the learning curve around homeschooling, and Khan mm-hmm. Academy has been a great resource, but you know, that's only because I have access to the internet. But one of the things we don't have access to and that I rely on is the library, because children's books are so expensive. You know, we're talking $14, $15 a pop. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you want them to be well read, my goal is to, you know, get them to read as many books as possible that are on those, you know, New York Public Library lists that every mm-hmm. kid should read, or any of those lists. And, you know, to buy all those could be thousands, you know, we're talking thousands and thousands of dollars. So now we've got to figure out new ways to give them access to those books. And Amazon has actually raised the price on their ebooks. I see that those prices are on par now with hardcover books. But you just highlighted your concerns, and this is important, about how COVID-19 will impact low-income communities. And We know you as a staunch advocate for the Lifeline program, which is really the only federal subsidy that provides low-income households with access to voice and broadband services. You know, these are the same communities that will be adversely impacted by this public health crisis. You know, given the fact that Lifeline was not included in the third congressional stimulus package, do you think there are other things the FCC can do within your authority to help bolster this community during this emergency?
Yeah. And Joe, much like you last week and your listeners as well, I was alarmed by the surge of 3.3 million Americans filing for unemployment assistance, the largest in U.S. history, and it's not even close. Nearly six times larger than the next largest surge for folks seeking unemployment assistance. And so as the adage goes, you know, things are likely to get worse before they get better. And millions of Americans truly are struggling. And so that means more people are going to need our safety net to catch them in these challenging times. And so, as you mentioned, the Lifeline program is the only federal subsidy specifically designed for the communication needs of vulnerable and struggling households. And so it's going to be even more crucial, as we know that millions of Americans are going to be sliding into a more vulnerable and struggling status. And so just to highlight a few things that I think the FCC can and should be doing for those folks right now. And that is, to start, it really sounds simple, but it's a real big problem. And it's that people need to actually know about the Lifeline program, that it exists, and that it's something that is going to help them get connected to a smartphone. And by the way, this job is only going to get more difficult now because of the places that people usually turn to in times of need: churches, community organizations, you know, like the YMCA, for instance, comes to mind. All of those physical spaces are closed right now. So we've got to update our thinking and messaging to get people out there connected to these phones, even if they're physically isolated. And so in this country, we have about 38 million people who are eligible for a Lifeline program from this January. And we only know that a little over 7 million people are actually enrolled in the program. So to do the math for you here, that's roughly 19 to 20% participation rate. People who actually are eligible for a Lifeline phone that actually get a phone in their hand. And so the commission has to devote more resources to let people know in low-income communities and get the knowledge out there to inform them that there's a way that they can get help. Couple other thoughts. We also expect millions more Americans are going to enroll in SNAP. That obviously helps them with their food insecurity issues, which is critically important. We know SNAP was part of this third stimulus package. You know, but one of the ways that you qualify for a Lifeline phone, a low-income phone, is as a SNAP recipient. So there truly are natural synergies here. And we need to help make sure that folks who are struggling, that we see around the corner for them and help get them the benefit of a suite of government services that they're going to need to help them during this challenge challenging time. And then, you know, the last thing I'd say really quickly, Joe, is that I'm glad you did bring up that, you know, that congressional stimulus package. There's likely going to be a fourth stimulus package, is everything that I hear. And I'm hopeful that it has a connectivity stimulus that I've called for. You know, to fight this COVID-19, we know that millions more Americans are truly going to need the internet, you know, whether that's for teleworking, for school and telelearning, like you talked about, for medical care and telemedicine, and simply just connecting with loved ones. We've got to make sure that the FCC steps up.
What about doing an ad campaign? Does the FCC have the resource to say, for example, you know, someone does a Google search for Riverside Church or Bing search for Riverside Church? Well, even though those churches are closed, if they were served with a Google ad that tells them information about the Lifeline program?
All options need to be on the table. And you know, administratively making sure that folks know that there is programming out there, and if folks are turning to a shelter or to a church because they are in times of need, we do need to figure out a way to help them make the connection to a Lifeline phone. Obviously, this is, you know, to some degree, it's a need money to make money situation. You're talking about somebody, the Lifeline phone is to make sure that they have that essential basic connectivity, giving them a smartphone that they can use in their home. And so part of the issue here is how do you, especially in a physically isolated world where you're talking about the disconnected, you know, how do you get the message out there, especially other than, the challenges of posting something like that on the internet? You know, maybe we do need to rely on a word of mouth to some degree, but we've got to figure out a better channel to reach these folks that are struggling.
We're going to take a quick break here, but when we come back, we'll hear more about your recent op-ed and a little bit more about what you're working on. Stay with us. Op-ed in the New York Times, and I found it interesting that given all of the, you know, constant chatter about the lack of connectivity in rural areas, which is important, and your recent southern tour in Alabama and Georgia, you highlighted that the Census Bureau surveys show that there, you know, three times as many households in urban areas remain unconnected than in rural ones. Can you speak to that a bit and specifically hone in on how the COVID-19 pandemic is impacting kids who lack access in urban areas, and what more can be done to get them connected, and what data we should be relying on to really get the right information when it comes to rural versus urban, and, you know, what the true statistics are when it comes to connectivity?
Yeah, I think the first point that has to be made here at a macro level, at a policy setting level, is that, you know, in no way are we trying to pit rural communities against urban communities when we're talking about broadband connectivity. And a lot of attention has been paid to the issue of access and rural areas in particular. And I think that's extremely important. You know, over my time as a commissioner, I've traveled to, you know, South Georgia, to Alabama, to the Pueblos of New Mexico, Southern Ohio, places where the internet truly has not reached. But Census Bureau data shows that at the same time, as you mentioned, nearly three times as many households in urban areas are unconnected as those in rural areas. And so we have to acknowledge that millions more people in urban areas, including right here in Washington, are not connected. And that really comes down to the headline issue of affordability. Experts estimate that more than 18 million households, that's households, lack broadband simply because it's too expensive. And so I have called for more broadband providers to offer a low-cost tier option for basic internet connections. In times of emergency, I firmly believe that no American should go without an internet connection because of the cost.
So, you know, a lot of people are saying, though, Commissioner Starks, that pricing regulation and even regulating the data caps would be a free speech infringement. that content regulate, that it's a form of content regulation. What are your thoughts on that? Or do I have that argument right?
I don't. I'm not sure I've heard that argument. The data caps would be more of an issue where, we know that millions more Americans are teleworking from home, right? And it takes a lot more data for me to upload, my statements, upload content. And so we are, each of us, using more data in our homes than ever before, considering none of us, for the most part, are working. Telemedicine. Actually just physically, I know with my family and with friends and loved ones, I have connected through, virtual connections like FaceTime, for instance, a lot more. And so those are kind of the data. We're all consuming more data in our homes and making sure that somebody is not running up against their data cap where, a carrier says, well, you've used your data for the month, Jeffrey Starks. And so if you're going to use more data, we're going to have to charge you more, or then they're going to slow down your internet connection. I don't think we can have that considering how much more we're all relying on our connectivity right now. And so that's what I've focused on. I've also called for wireless providers to waive some of their data caps in affected areas. It's going to be essential that we use all of the tools in our toolbox to make sure that we are getting more Americans connected than ever. And that includes everywhere in the whole spectrum of Americans, from our youngest learners up to the elderly, who are increasingly vulnerable, of course, these days. And the last thing that I said, we talked about Congress and some funding issues. It's going to also require that we think administratively at the commission about how to eliminate some red tape, extend regulatory flexibility to allow broadband providers to quickly expand their access, expedite decisions on waivers, experimental licenses, deploying unused and inefficiently used wireless spectrum, making the stock of lendable free hotspots available to schools and libraries for these unconnected students. We really have got to think creatively and urgently.
So you mentioned kids, and I'm sure you're homeschooling, or are you homeschooling like I am?
I am. I've got a toddler age kiddo here in addition to a 1.5-year-old. And so, some of those materials that are designed for young learners have become essential in our home.
Yeah. Yeah. We just started Khan Academy today, and it's great because they have lesson plans. Final ideas. What are some final thoughts you'd like to leave with us before we close? And where can we find you online?
Yes. Please look me up on Twitter. I do talk about substantive issues, but also some lighthearted stuff as well. And you can reach me. I'm at Jeffrey Starks. That's at GeoffreyStarks. Again, that's at Jeffrey Starks, GeoffreyStarks. Final parting thoughts would really be that, humans are, of course, social creatures, and we crave that interaction. Connectivity has become essential and central to, our way of life, to our safety, to our economy, and our security. And so I've called for this connectivity stimulus because for the first time ever, in responding to an emergency pandemic, Americans are going to have to rely on the internet extensively for an indeterminate amount of time. And so millions more Americans, all Americans, have got to get connected right now. And so eager to work with and hear from anyone who can help in that fight. And of course, always be safe.
FCC Commissioner Jeffrey Starks, who wrote a recent op-ed in the New York Times, to fight coronavirus, millions more Americans need internet access. You can find that in the show notes. Commissioner Jeffrey Starks, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for the time, Joe.
And that concludes episode 225 of the podcast. Thanks so much for listening. If you like what we do here, we'd love to hear from you. Please leave us a review and rating at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Help others make a decision about what to listen to in these times when folks aren't listening to podcasts as much as they did when they were driving to work. So it would really help us out if you left a few few reviews for us to all of you who are listening. I hope you're staying healthy. Centers for Disease Control now recommends wearing masks when you go outside. You don't necessarily need the N95 masks. Save those for the healthcare workers. But what you can do, which I saw online from a doctor, is take a t-shirt and, you know, fold it up so that it looks like a mask, you know, into a rectangle or whatever, so you can tie it behind your head. But between the shirt and your face, put a paper towel there, because the Chinese have found that a paper towel is the most effective filter against germs. So that's the protocol. Stay healthy, and remember, I'm here for you, and I'll see you back here next week. Take care.